Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Eric Klein.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Waits.
And I'm Paul Reese-Mandel.
And on today's episode, Jennifer Waits is back from touring radio stations in December of 2022, which is a very special event here on Radio Survivor because it's the first time that Jennifer Waits has conducted one of her radio station tours since the pandemic. So it's been
It
must have been bittersweet, Jennifer, to get back on the road and go visit radio stations. You were able to visit a number of stations this time around.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely not bittersweet. It was very exciting. I had last visited radio stations in the summer of 2019 on my trip to Hawaii, which also, like, that seems like, you know, kind of a last hurrah sort of trip before, a few months before COVID. But yeah, here in November 2022, I made a trip out to New York and visited four radio stations. So, you know, it was very exciting to get my planning muscles all situated again. Because that's part of what I enjoy about it is the logistics of how many stations can I squeeze into a trip.
Right. And regular listeners to Radio Survivor will be very familiar with Jennifer Waits' radio station tours and the reasons to visit a station. But I think it'd be fun to remind listeners once again, especially someone who might be hearing us for the first time on the radio. And maybe, Paul, you can help me frame this question right, because I'd rather toss to you first and then go to Jennifer. Paul, like, why are Jennifer's radio station tours, why?
Why are they important? Why should we care about them?
Yeah.
We should care about them because, you know, the types of stations that Jennifer visits are college radio stations, high school radio stations, community radio stations, and each is sort of very unique and often they're very storied. They have long-lasting histories that aren't always easily captured or researched, honestly. And that's much of the work that Jennifer has done to capture it, both in terms of audio and podcasts, as well as publishing tours and articles about different stations. And each has a different culture and really, you know, we hope reflects both their local communities, you know, which and there can be many constituencies there, students, faculty, community members, musicians, artists, and other constituencies within a community. And each one says something about these communities and also highlights, I think, the relationship of radio as a medium to actual communities, to people, and creativity in a way that has often been lost in commercial broadcasting at this point, where programming, even if it isn't explicitly syndicated, is much more likely now to be programmed at regional levels, to be automated, to have fewer local hosts, in some cases no hosts at some hours of the day, reflecting a little less local culture than it had, you know, even 20 years ago and certainly 40 years ago. So often a community college and public radio stand is different sort of media outlets. And so I think Jennifer's work helps us to sort of understand them as unique, but also sort of your work always threads together the things which kind of tie them as a medium as well.
Very well stated. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, so, I mean, I've been writing about college radio culture since 2008. And early in that project, I had a couple goals in mind when I started blogging about college radio. I wanted the broader world to understand that college radio still exists and was important. But I also wanted college radio stations to hear stories about other stations, because from my experience working in college radio, at a number of places, often things are very insular and people, you know, are busy working the day-to-day, you know, doing all the day-to-day stuff at a station and often don't know what other radio stations are doing. And when people meet people from other radio stations, often they're very excited and learn things from them. And, you know, every time I visit a radio station, I'm learning things. So I wanted to kind of pass that along to other people by sharing these stories from different radio stations so that there could be this collective learning about, you know, college radio culture. So you know, it's...
I wanted to kind of, if I can follow up real quick
on
that, Jennifer, because I think another function that's really important is, you know, I think we hope that we're serving people who are in radio, in and around radio, as well as listeners and enthusiasts. Because my experience often has been in community stations and college stations, there is they can be sort of atomic, and there's a limited networking between these stations in many ways. So even if there are formal like kind of associations and collaborations, like College Broadcasters Incorporated or the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, you know, very often it's only a select number of staff members or volunteers who participate in these larger kind of collaborations, you know, often just for real practical reasons, right? And therefore, I think your ability to tie it together and actually the real function of you going to these stations, right, is there too, in that it sort of, my experience has been that often the volunteers, DJs, programmers aren't really aware that they sit within a larger context, that, you know, their stations are unique to them and what they do, and they may understand why their station is unique where they are and unique maybe compared to other stations on the dial, but aren't always aware that there are so many other college stations, so many other community stations that are similar in sort of the flexibility and freedom and creativity, even if the programming can differ pretty widely. And I think the final follow-up I have is you visiting the stations is validation, right? That you pay attention to them, treat them as institutions worthy of note, worthy of documentation, and worthy of sharing outside of their communities, I think also provides that sense that they are doing something larger and that it has a larger import, even if the focus on their local communities may be primary most of the time.
Yeah, and I definitely hear that when I visit radio stations, and sometimes people are really excited, and on one of these visits somebody's like, I hope you don't mind that I kind of like looked you up. Like, that's okay. So it thrills me when I arrive and people have told me that they've been digging around on Radio Survivor, reading other station reports. And I, you know, I've talked to people who have been making changes to their studio or starting a new radio station. And I know that they've looked at some of these college radio station tours to help them kind of imagine like, oh, okay, this is what a studio looks like. And, you know, maybe I can try things this way. So I do think of it as this important archive, hopefully, you know, an archive of what's been happening in college radio during the 21st century. And that's, you know, that's part of why I'm a bit obsessive about it. I'd like to visit as many radio stations as I can. So it's been kind of a bummer, you know, for all of us to really be living in these more sort of insular worlds the past few years. And stations themselves, a lot of them have really placed restrictions on who can come in and out of the doors, like not just visitors like me, but, you know, there's some stations that aren't even really letting in outsiders generally, you know, aren't necessarily having bands come in to play on the air. Some may still have restrictions on community volunteers, like some college radio stations, I think, became more restrictive about having only students. So and it felt like this opportunity in November was kind of the right time. It felt like stations were probably going to let me in their doors in November 2022, and that was the case. You know, I was able to visit four radio stations, and it definitely felt like things had shifted, that things are starting to open up, and you know, and I'm seeing this, you know, it's like, I hate to say renaissance or rebirth, but you know, you see this in college radio, especially student-run stations, like even without a pandemic. You see ebb and flow with different students, that, you know, stations go through periods of where there's a lot of, you know, strong leadership and lots of activity, lots of student involvement, and then other periods where things seem to be on the verge of death, you yeah. know. And
well, Jennifer, you said you visited four stations, right, on this yes. journey this in November of 2022, prior to the holiday season kicking off, so the schools were open and available. Let's start with one station where maybe you got that sense of this so-called renaissance of college radio that you were just referring to.
Yeah, so my first visit, you know, the first visit after a few years, was at University at Albany. It's a SUNY school in Albany. WCDB FM is the radio station there. So I visited there, you know, like within like an hour and a half of landing in Albany. So I rented my car and drove to the radio station at night, and the station was kind of abuzz with activity. It was a Wednesday night, and they have on Wednesday nights they have kind of an open training session. So there were a bunch of people in the studio who were learning how to do radio. They were preparing for a big fall concert that they were hosting at a club in Albany in a couple days. So they were printing out flyers for that when I was there, and just doing all the last minute logistics. And, you know, it just felt like the place was alive. And, you know, and in talking to them, I know that it wasn't really alive during the pandemic, and, you know, there were restrictions, and but it feels like that gave them an opportunity to kind of change a few things at the station too. Like, one of the most inspiring things to me was learning that the station now, like, the people who are involved with the station feel more reflective of the campus community. It's much more diverse, feels more diverse to the leadership than it did when they started before the pandemic. And the general manager was saying that, you know, she wasn't really seeing people who looked like her when she joined, and now it seems more diverse. And that's something that, in visiting and talking to radio stations, I know a lot of places struggle with, you know, how do we have a station that, you know, has people of all colors, you know, women and men, a variety of ages. And a lot of people just like, a lot of stations just seem to have a real struggle with figuring out how to change kind of the entrenched population who's in the radio station. And what I learned from them is that they decided that college radio historically can be very gatekeepery. That was some of the language they were using with me. And so they decided, you know, the way that the station is going to be more interesting and have more interesting programming is if they decide to not be gatekeepers and to be incredibly welcoming to anyone and not have this sort of attitude about, you know, you have to like the cool music according to me. And this is probably something that feels familiar to a lot of you. Like, I remember being, you know, going to a meeting for one of the stations one of the college stations I DJ'd at, and we had to fill out index cards and write down a list of some of our favorite bands. And I wrote down like some very like underground cool bands. And I remember the program director like calling me out by name, like, "Oh, who's Jennifer Waits?" And I got like the total nod of approval because I had the cool bands on there. So like for me, like, okay, I was like acknowledged and that worked. But there's a flip side of that where other people probably felt, you know, shamed if they didn't have a cool band on their card. So I think it's very interesting that WCDB at University at Albany is taking this approach of being less gatekeepery, more open-minded, and just like being a place that's welcoming of everybody, and not being so precious maybe about the air sound. And because of that, they feel like they have now, they have people hanging out at the station. They have all kinds of interesting shows. So that I found to be really inspiring to hear that story.
You know, you mentioned that you came, they were having training. So is that training sort of ongoing? It sounded right. Is that what you said, that they do it kind of frequently, training people how to be on the air?
Yeah, it's like a drop-in training session every Wednesday night.
I think that's fascinating, right? Because I think there's a lot of, you mentioned sort of dropping the gatekeeping or trying to reduce it, right? And that's, you know, often while that's gatekeepery, I think in the realm of, you know, existing in a saturated mainstream media environment, in many cases in the past, it also functioned as a differentiator. It is defensive, right? You know, and I'm just thinking back historically with college radio and reading treatises, say, in the 70s and 80s, and I think you're familiar with this, Jennifer, when college radios could be threatened, stations could be threatened sometimes because they sounded too much like mainstream radio. And so an administrator would sort of question, well, why are we replicating something that you hear on the local rock station, the same artist and music? What function does that play? I remember in the proceeding that got rid of Class D stations, 10-watt stations, back in 1978, part of the argument against the Class D stations was they merely replicate existing radio formats more amateurishly. Right. And so because part of the reasoning there was that the way should be made for more professionally run public service stations, ostensibly public stations. Right. So that's kind of worked against college radio in particular in some ways in the past. And I think in that era that maybe you and I came up with, because I experienced the same gatekeeperism, in the late 80s, and I'd liked metal, and that was sort of like acceptable, but not acceptable in a way, right? Because it wasn't really mainstream, the kind of metal I liked. But certainly the punk and alternative kids looked down their nose at metal as well. Like it was, you could have your little few hours here or there, but we don't consider it to be the same, Black Sabbath is not Black Flag, right? It's essentially, which would have been an argument. And in some ways, you can understand it because of trying to differentiate and not turn into just sort of the college version of that. But I think, a lot has changed in the intervening 30 years as well in the culture, in radio, and the diversity that I think people now consume on the internet, whether it's through a TikTok or YouTube, whether it's music or music adjacent, right? Using music kind of changes things up a lot now, right? And I think it's useful to note that, what may have been somewhat more defensible, I don't want to just say it was absolutely necessary 30 years ago, the context has changed now in 2022.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad you're talking about genres too, because that was another thing that came up, but at University of Albany at WCDB was, I think young people are used to kind of embracing a variety of genres but also having an identifier. So the training director there, DJ Castro, was talking about how he arrived and he was just kind of a hip hop person. And now he's a total metalhead too. And so like being at the station, talking to people about music, getting exposed to all kinds of things. And they also talked about another guy who arrived as a metalhead who now has a doo-wop show. So I love that college radio can have that function too, where, you don't have to be, you can be open to a variety of genres. And he and the general manager both talked about how subgenres are so important to them at the station, which I thought was cool, that they like digging into kind of all these little niches within music.
I wonder, Jennifer, did the S word ever come up? Because this year, more than ever, I'm very aware now of the I'll just out my teenage son. To him, the music that he cares about and the music that he loves and the music that he listens to is one platform, one app on his phone, dare I mention it, that doesn't need any more free advertisement from the likes of me, who sometimes posts about the genres of music I enjoy on my Facebook advertising this particular company. But I imagine that these days when a young person comes to a college radio station, they're not coming with a CD collection. It's all playlists on their phone.
Yeah, I mean, and that's how some people do their radio shows. So I heard, I visited four stations. So I did hear some people mention that, you know, people might have been playing their shows off of, you know, digital sources. But on the contrast, I also heard from some people who talked about how radio is still important, even in the era of S, as you say. you know,
even if they offered us money, I don't think we would take it. So I just...
Right. And DJ Castro, who I mentioned, the training director at WCDB, he talked about how, you know, college radio is important for, you know, exposing or, you know, for giving a platform for up and coming bands.
Right.
And he seems to see that that's continuing today. And he also talked about kind of the tradition of college radio, and that he looks back to people like Flavor Flav and Stretch and Bobbito, like college radio DJs from the past, who he saw, you know, doing that functioning in that way, and feels like he's part of that legacy, which I think is really cool for a 19-year-old to kind of be talking about this legacy of college radio and how he's situated in it.
That's wonderful. And did they think at all in any way about how to make the case to their peers that they should switch from this one particular app that their parents still might be footing the bill for to tune into the radio, where, you know, because all they can hear all of these songs whenever they want to, you
it's
know,
probably an and rather than an or, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it would be for me too. I mean, I use a streaming service and I listen to the radio, so I don't think that they have to be exclusive.
Yes, but it's easier for you who we grew up with radio first, and so the convenience of the thing doesn't supersede the nostalgia and the value that we know exists. I'm just wondering how a teenager wades through that these days.
I mean, yeah, we didn't have that specific conversation, but I was having some of the terrestrial radio, you know, FM, like FM radio, because three of the four stations I visited are on FM, but also streaming. One station I visited, WXBC at Bard College, you can hear their shows on Mixlr. Is that how you pronounce it? Mixlr. It's an online platform. But there was a station. There's a station. Now I'm forgetting the whole the context of it. But there was a station where you couldn't listen online currently. And so I was trying to wrap my head around like how people, you know, the stream wasn't working and young people don't really listen to terrestrial radio. So I was trying to get my head around and ask people about what it was like to do a radio show. You know, do you have an audience? Like, is there anybody listening in the student population if the stream's not working? And it was hard to get a read on that, which I thought was kind of weird and fascinating, but it might also be that in this sort of social media world, sometimes you have fans and friends who, you know, like it seems like they're listening, but they're not really. They're just kind of liking your posts. And it sounds like some people in this particular case might have been doing Instagram Live because the stream wasn't working.
Pirate radio.
Yeah.
And they might listen in cars. There's still current data still shows that young people still listen to broadcast in vehicles, like that's still pretty common. I did want to circle back for one thing before we move on to another station here, talking about WCDB at University at Albany. That drop in training really struck me, right? Because if there's, like you mentioned, you know, it's all in the spirit of trying to minimize the gatekeeping. So if there's cultural gatekeeping is what we normally associate, right? There is also that technical gatekeeping. And often that's more instrumental, right? But can also serve as a leveling device, meaning having the training means that it does not necessarily provide an advantage for somebody who comes in maybe already with some technical audio skills. But to have drop-in training, like, removes another barrier because, you know, it means that you don't have to necessarily commit to this one time that maybe only occurs like once a semester or once every so often, right? Because very often I think it's just people take by default, we'll have a big meeting, everybody comes and learns about the station, and that's a place where maybe you sign up for your training and maybe they're smaller. But like if you miss that moment, you're out of luck for a semester or maybe a full academic year, depending on the station. And to sort of create that drop-in opportunity, right? And maybe to be more fluid and not necessarily be so strict about timing, like that's another type of gatekeeping. And, you know, honestly, you know, it's only, I would say, probably just tradition and habit why stations often will organize these things. Not because they've really thought about it, right? And sort of rethinking, you know, what it means to orient people to a radio station and get them involved. I think that's very clever at the very least, but potentially very powerful in a college radio environment, especially since in so many stations, you do have that ebb and flow of this year, there's a lot of people being involved and other years not. And sometimes there's a tendency to say, well, just students aren't interested and not think about, well, what are the mechanisms that might be providing speed bumps, right, or making it more difficult for people to participate. And I love this idea of having more of a drop-in training and allowing it to be less formalized in a particular way, shall we say.
I think it probably also gives the impression that the station is a place you can drop into and hang out at, which, like, I saw, you know, there were, I don't know, maybe 7 or more people crammed into a small studio for drop-in training. And then there were other people just hanging out on couches in another room. So I would guess that having the drop-in training also kind of sets the stage for the culture at the station being a place where you can hang out. So yeah, I thought that was, I agree with you. I thought that was a really cool idea.
That was the voice of Jennifer Waits. You are listening to Radio Survivor, and Jennifer is here regaling us with the details of her recent travels to visit 4 radio stations in the New York State area. The first time that Jennifer has visited non-commercial community college radio stations since the pandemic began, these many years ago. I'm afraid to put a month and a date on it because I always get it wrong. I can't remember what year it is practically. My name is Eric Klein. With me is Paul Riesmandel, who's also from Radio Survivor. And Jennifer, we've been talking about WCDB, the University at Albany radio station. Let's move on to one of the next stations we should talk about.
Yeah, I don't even know if I can do them all justice, but I think maybe, let's see, where should I go next? I think the next one I want to talk about is WRUC FM at Union College in Schenectady. And that's a station I've been wanting to visit for a long time because they have this lore about having one of the first college radio stations because they had a college radio station in the 1920s. And I'd already been in contact over the years with an archivist there because I'm working on a presentation about student-run radio in the 1920s. And so that I knew that Union College was going to be a part of that presentation. So I was super excited. And so I spent a whole day there. I met up with people in the archives, and then I also toured the student radio station. So WRUC FM. And then now after the trip, I've been kind of obsessing over a bunch of digital resources that I can access from home. So I've been looking at newspapers from the 1920s and yearbooks. It was amazing. When we visited the archives, they pulled out scrapbooks for the radio club from the 1920s. And it's so tough for me to visit the archives when I have a limited amount of time because there's so much I want to look at. But we paged through some of these scrapbooks and it was letter after letter, people basically giving these reports of what they had heard. And at the time of this scrapbook, it would have been an amateur radio station. So the station, starting in 1920 at Union College, their amateur radio station was sending out broadcasts of music. So they actually borrowed records and played records And then other amateur radio operators tuned in and listened. So, you know, the hardcore historians will say, well, this wasn't like a broadcast station at that point. But reading through these newspaper reports, it's pretty incredible. And some listeners were kind of having dance parties at home to the music. Wow. So it really was functioning like a broadcast radio station.
And this is, I mean, obvious to some Radio Survivor listeners and new information to others. It's worth reminding people that 1920 would be, you know, more or less the very beginning of radio in the United States.
And as a broadcast medium rather than a sort of strictly one-to-one communications medium.
So when young people at this college radio station in Schenectady, New York in the 1920s were engaging in the creation of radio, they were really doing just that. They were really creating what radio was in, you know, for the century. It's always very exciting to hear how people made radio in the 1920s, especially college
radio. It's so exciting. And they did have, so I haven't gotten to this point in my digging into newspaper articles, but I think around 1920-22 they got a license for a broadcast radio station. So they also legitimately had a very early student licensed broadcast radio station. But I wanted to share with you some of the stuff that I've been uncovering. A student newspaper report in October 1920 talked about how the radio club will be advertising the college, basically, and they're calling it, the headline is, Radio Club will advertise union by aerial phone, is what they're referring to it as, aerial phone. And so they talked about how using the amateur radio station, it was a way to advertise Union College to other people. And so they started doing these weekly broadcasts of music. And at the end of the broadcast, they also had a call to amateur radio operators, who they assumed a lot of them were young people, telling them, hey, you should come to Union College for college because you can learn about electrical engineering. So I thought that was fascinating. And the same article said that, I'll quote, now that athletics are below par and their advertising value virtually lost, the radio club believes that its latest activity will help greatly in bringing Union into prominence.
Take that, NCAA.
Fascinating. And, you know, I also do research. I went to Haverford College, and they students there started a radio station in 1923. And some newspaper reports about that, the amateur station's activities, were that, you know, they've received more press than all of the athletic teams combined. So it's interesting in both cases, this competition that these early radio stations saw with the athletic teams on campus, like it was a fight for publicity. But then at Union, this idea that, you know, having a radio station is a way to really bring more attention to your college. So it's interesting, like when you start researching this stuff, you end up learning things that you didn't realize that you were looking for.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the value of physically being in a space, getting to touch documents as well, and to talk to people. Who did you meet when you were at this Union College station in Schenectady?
Well, so I met with people in the archives, the main archivist, as well as other colleagues there. And then I also met with the advisor for the college radio station and students from the college radio station. So it was kind of, you know, multiple things, like spent some specific time in the archives looking at stuff, and then also talking to students. Talked to somebody who had a long history with the station, and he was talking about all of these records, like vinyl records that they used to have that were all trashed and how they were all gotten rid of. And there's a student in the room who just looked crestfallen. And I sort of like also was probably looking crestfallen, like, because he was talking about this insane number of records. I'm like, how could they all be trashed? You know, like, I was very skeptical. And he's like, oh, they were, they really were. But there's always this kind of you know, I started researching the history of college radio stations after, you know, hearing these stories about my own college radio station getting rid of records, selling them off to fund a concert. Like, there was a whole rumor about it. And I remember being really upset about it. But the more I do research, the more I am more understanding about how you can't be so precious about your time at the station as that, as being, you don't want it to be, it can't be frozen in amber. But that's a lot of times how we feel as alums. We want to go back and see the records that we added, and but stations are constantly changing, and that has, the radio station has to be, has to serve the students who are there at a given time.
Right. And you started off talking about Union College's radio station as a historical special place where had as a history of 100 years, but what kind of station do they have in the present?
Yeah, so they have a couple things. They have a studio kind of in the middle of the student center that has windows facing out where people are eating, and there are speakers so that you can blast people sitting there. And this guy who had been involved with the station from way back, he revealed that he had first built that studio there because at the time, and I don't know when it was, maybe the station was just maybe at a low point. And so he saw this space that used to be like a video rental place where people would go and get their videos. And he's like, oh, this would be great for a radio studio. And so they built that there so that the station would have a very prominent presence where, you know, people would see it.
One of your favorite, landscape or architectural features for college radio, for a college radio station to have a window and audio facing the dining area is like it's a very good opportunity for the station to have a public have a public space where it can be heard and shared.
Definitely. And interestingly, so I didn't see any DJs operating out of that studio when I was there. And I was told that they have the option of turning the speakers on or off. So a lot of DJs don't necessarily feel comfortable having the speakers on. So that's up to them.
The one time I froze on the radio, live on the radio, and just had complete dead air was when a colleague of mine locked eyes with me while I was trying to do my job, and that surprise eye contact completely erased all sense of professionalism and changed my radio persona.
I know, it's true. Yeah, I mean, often you have to just sort of be in a completely different headspace. So in addition to that studio, they've got an older studio that, like, the architecture of it reminds me so much of my own college radio station, you know, back from the 80s. So in a different floor of the building is the original space that has kind of like a 3-room studio where there's a broadcast booth and then a studio like space and then a lobby type space. And it sounds like they're having talks about reconfiguring because I think something is wrong, so they can't actually broadcast out of that studio currently. So things are a bit in transition, I would say, at WRUC. And I would have liked to have seen somebody DJing in that booth downstairs. I was told somebody was supposed to have a Bollywood show that was going to be on around that time, and we were really looking forward to it, but didn't end up seeing anybody broadcasting. So interesting. Like, I've been spending so much more time thinking about the past of WRUC, and the present is a little bit murkier. Although I did get to have some interviews with students talking about the current state of the station and how things were, you know, as they transitioned through the pandemic. I think it was a bit of a struggle for them. Yeah. So.
I mean, you talking about not being able to see a DJ perform live radio, you know, while you were visiting reminds me that that's obviously this was a transition to time shifted radio work, to DJs not being live on the radio has been a long time coming, decades in the making. But live radio, especially community radio, really seems to, you know, I know when we talked to Ken Freeman at the very beginning of the pandemic, that was the one thing that he wanted to preserve the most, I think, was that the sense that the DJ that you are hearing speak into the microphone and share records with you right now is actually sharing records with you right now. It's that immediacy was important to WFMU's general manager at that time. And it still seems to be very complicated to pull off these days. You know, I'm always aware now listening to my community radio stations that chances are that person recorded themselves at home like a day or two earlier.
Well, and even before 2020, college radio stations might not have a full schedule of live DJs. So, you know, I wasn't always seeing somebody live on the air when I visited, even before this trip. But yeah, I don't think I saw anybody who was live on the air. And at one station, you know, in some cases I was visiting early in the morning. So like chances are at a college radio station, that's going to be a time when you might not see people live. And I visited Bard College, WXBC, and we chose a time on purpose where there wasn't a live show so that we could be in the studio and not disturb anybody. So that's kind of an unfair, or, you know, that doesn't mean that nobody was there all the time. But I did get a chance to hear some live shows at some of these stations over the radio. So like at WCDB, they were doing that training show, which I saw, and then I heard one of the people that I interviewed, I heard him later on the radio, which is fun. Like, I always enjoy that. This happens to me occasionally where I meet up with somebody at a station, and then when I'm driving away afterwards, that person is doing their show. So that's, I love that.
Yeah, you get to meet them two different ways. Jennifer, you just mentioned Bard College. Jennifer Waits, you took a trip on your own behalf, but also on behalf of Radio Survivor, to visit college radio stations in the New York State area. And I know that you shared with us that when you visited Bard, one of the students you met there is working on their senior thesis on the station history.
Yes, I was so excited. She, Tamar Fagan, she'd actually reached out to some colleagues of mine on the Radio Preservation Task Force to let us know she was working on her thesis about the Bard College radio station. And I realized that this was kind of close to where I was going in New York. And so I reached out to her and then realized she was the general manager too, of course. So the student doing their history thesis on the station is also the general manager. And it was so great and really inspiring. I mean, this is what I kind of wish would happen at every college radio station, that a history student would write their thesis on the history. So she's uncovered so much interesting stuff in a very short period of time, including, you know, because she was digging into things, somebody on campus in a random closet found a recording of the very first broadcast of the station in the 1940s.
That's very rare.
I know. And it was something that was received later. So I think it was on a cassette tape, but a cassette had been made of a transcription disc at one point. So she played this for me while I was there, and it was just incredible. And she's also been able to do oral history type interviews with some alums who are from they graduated in the 1940s. So
that's impressive too.
Yeah. And in the process of that, she learned things about her own family members who are in radio that she never knew, because she was talking about this project and they're like, oh, I did radio. And she's like, what? So, you know, she had a grandparent who was involved in radio. So, yeah, it was really, really cool to hear some of this history. And also, you know, also hear that station, WXBC, is another station that's kind of on an upswing after having a period of relative inactivity. And often it happens because you have students who are very, you know, excited about the radio station, excited about kind of bringing things back and getting people involved. I mentioned, they're on an online platform called MixLR, which has a chat feature incorporated. So I listened to one of the shows before I went out to New York, and it was this great show about the history of goth. And the DJ even went back to talk about goth in, you know, what does the term goth mean historically, and talked about gothic architecture and talked about proto-goth bands and played a bunch of stuff that I never really thought about in the context of goth music. So that was cool. I left this whole trip being very excited that, you know, it's not just old people like me and, you know, alums like me who are interested in history. Like, it's great to see students who are interested in history. So she's going to complete this thesis project. They've been also airing some alumni interviews over the air. So, I mean, that's another thing that I've talked to some radio stations about. You know, if you have historical items or historical recordings, how can you bring those to life at your station? So I think that's great too, that it's not, this material is not just living in her student project. It's also material that's being shared with listeners over their radio station.
You mentioned, Jennifer, that WXBC at Bard College is experiencing sort of renewed, refreshed interest, which seems to be a pattern at the stations that you visited. You know, is there something specific at WXBC? Do you think they've made some sort of initiative that made the station more welcoming or popular as well, similar to like WCDB?
I don't know. I mean, some of this is, I think some of this just has to do with the post-COVID situation where...
I wondered that too, yeah.
You know, things are just opening up more and people are allowed to congregate again. And, you know, the masks, I think at a few places I visited, you know, it was maybe the beginning of not having to wear masks. So some of it, I think, might be what all of us are experiencing in the world where, you know, we want to be getting together with people again and hanging out. And so radio stations can serve that purpose.
And I think that's an aspect that folks who might not have ever been involved in radio from the production side don't always recognize or understand it. And just from a lack of knowledge that, you know, a college radio station, you know, it is a club for all intents and purposes, right? Often formally within a university or college, and that the collaboration and the gathering are critical components of it, even if sometimes some shows or DJs can be a little atomic, right? They just simply come in, they do their thing. That isn't necessarily how it is. And often, you know, if there's too much of that, sometimes is not good for the station because you lose the momentum that collaboration can provide.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real community. And I think this is what a lot of us struggled with during the height of the pandemic, was how do you maintain that sense of community at a radio station when community is so vital? You know, like we talk about at WCDB, like people are coming in and hanging out, sitting on the couches. I heard a lot about community at WCDB and how that's important. And the general manager there, she started at the station in fall 2019, and then COVID hit in the spring, and she didn't want to go home for the summer, you know, because of the pandemic. And so she ended up crashing on the couch of another person from the station. And so I heard stories about how these friendships were forged, and also how people were able to maintain a social life through station connections like that, where they weren't really going out and seeing many other people, but at least she was in a living space with somebody and having a social life. And, you know, similarly at WCDB, they talked about these connections with the local music scene. So you have like this pipeline from the radio station where there are people at the radio station who also play in bands in the community. There are alums who book shows, people at the station who also do sound at concerts locally. And so it's this whole kind of music ecosystem that's another, you know, so there's like the inside college radio community where you get to make friends, you're hanging out, chatting about music, collaborating on shows. But then you're also collaborating with the music community, the local scene, and how that actually becomes this legacy of the radio station where people are talking about like, oh, yeah, so-and-so used to be GM at the station and now she does this. And so I think people there feel these connections to this kind of rich, lengthy radio history, which is super cool.
Yeah, college radio stations tend to be some of the more integrated college activities, right? Integrated with the community, in my experience, in my observation, because often, right, connection to the music scene, which may involve students who may be in bands or go see bands, but often involves a much wider milieu, you know, and all these other cultural touch points, you know, and so, you know, I was hoping you say something about that so that I don't want us to inadvertently give off the sense that despite the sort of the community nature of radio stations, that they're insular to the station, right? And you're noting all these other touch points and how folks will graduate but stay in the community, right? And maybe continue the connections in some ways, either formally or informally, right? The passing through and knitting out a broader network that expands the ultimate circle. But another, you know, another theme I'm hearing in what you're sharing with these visits here, right? You said it. It's important that stations are not frozen in amber, right? And that they are evolving with, I mean, ultimately the colleges, the students, and the communities that they're situated in and that they serve. And I've often thought, and I'd like to know your take on this, Jennifer, that in times that stations that have faltered and been threatened, at times it seems as though they often have become fossilized for a number of reasons. In some way, they are getting frozen in amber. They don't update. And sometimes maybe that's due to the fact that there's less student involvement, so less fresh blood. And, you know, maybe community volunteers have too much prominence because they also don't leave on 4-year basis, right? They stick around longer.
Yeah.
Likely to change.
The gatekeeper topic
right.
from earlier in the day. And Paul, when you're referring to threatened, these stations, usually it's a very interesting historical moment that we've talked about a lot on Radio Survivor over the years but people might not be aware of how this works out there in the world, that the threats usually come from within somehow, that the university the powers that be.
Yeah, the university decides to rid itself of the license if it's a broadcast station, either through a sale or giving it away to another public radio organization, another organization that they feel might use it, you know, due to perceptions that the station isn't relevant or isn't relevant to students, or in many cases, it is true that there isn't much activity and the station isn't thriving and lively. But it seems that efforts to stay, to not be too beholden to the past, has the potential to have an opposite effect. What do you think, Jennifer?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the other thing I'm also thinking is there's so much onus put on students a lot of the time to kind of maintain the station from year to year. And so, you know, I give like so much credit to these students who are spending an inordinate amount of time running and operating radio stations, sometimes without much support. So I think that can be a real challenge when you have to rely on students to kind of hold the station up from year to year. And you know, it's helpful to have an advisor or somebody who can provide the institutional knowledge, you know, so that so things keep going, because, you know, a struggle I hear over and over again is that things like instructions for how some of the technology behind the scenes works, like doesn't get passed on. And so you might have a technical failure and then the station ends up in right. sort of a crisis mode. So I think it's complicated. It's complicated. There are a lot of different reasons why stations struggle or why stations survive. And I think that having a perspective of being a station for the students who are there now and not being frozen in amber, like we've mentioned, I think that's really important. And so some of the stations that I see starting up today are operating a little bit differently, like using different technology. Maybe they're just operating over social media. And to me, that's just as legit as an FM radio station, you know, people are, brand new stations that I'm encountering that are operating this way are kind of meeting students where they are. And that's, I think that's probably how they succeed also.
That makes a lot of sense. And you know, we're running out of time, so I don't want to go too far down this hole. But you mentioned advising, and I think that that probably does provide, has a potential to provide that continuity, which is much needed, right? And a good advisor will do that so that they're enabling the students to own the station truly, to really own what how it is, and provide the advice so that, you know, without being too overbearing, one hopes, in sort of also therefore instituting, you know, or forcing the past and making and forcing the station to be a particular way. And it's a balance. And that's any institution, that's any community radio station, that's probably any volunteer operated kind of organization. But it is a delicate balance, and perhaps it's when the balance is tipped too far one way, one might is when that is the potential for trouble begins.
Well, Jennifer Waits, you took a tour of four radio stations on behalf of Radio Survivor. You were back on the road to visit college radio stations and community radio stations, as you have done 100 and something times in the past. You got to go back out there here in 2022, in November of 2022. And I guess you're running out of time to summarize it, but I think the main thing you've shared with us is that there's a real enthusiasm for college radio.
There is. And it, you know, gets me enthusiastic about college radio. And I'm optimistic, as I often am when I visit stations.
Well, you've been listening to Radio Survivor here on the radio and as a podcast. You can find past episodes of the show at radiosurvivor.com, where we also have, well, we're a podcast that you can subscribe to. This is going to be the first new episode in a while. We're putting it out, but the past episodes are all there, both on your podcast app when you subscribe, as well as the website radiosurvivor.com. If you want to reach out to us, we will answer your email. podcast@radiosurvivor.com is the email address. On behalf of Paul Rees-Mendel and Jennifer Waits, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening. It was a pleasure to make a fresh episode for the radio show this week. See you next week.